As this fiscal year comes to a close, help set up WPR for another strong year of quality music, news, and entertainment. Give now at WPR.org/donate.
Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here, and today we have back Daniel Golden, and he has his summer book list. I love having him come to the show. I love his book list, and judging from emails and other response from you, you do as well. So he's always happy to do it. I'm happy to have him here, and he, of course, is owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and he's got I've looked the list over. He's got another great list for us. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. What's your favorite type of summer read, perhaps? Do you have a favorite new book to recommend? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Daniel Golden, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're taking us around the world with your list today, which I thought was pretty cool. What inspired you to do that?
Well, you asked me before the show if I ever go on vacation, and I said no. So I said I visit relatives in the same two places. So this is my vicarious way of traveling. And I think it's vaguely successful.
Oh, I would agree with you on that. And as I looked, you've got 20 books here, and I haven't read a single one, although I read some of the authors.
Oh, sure.
Other books. So let's get right to it. And we're going to Venice for the first book on your list, and it's called titled The Glassmaker. By Tracy Chevalier?
Yes. I had to whittle this down because I was reading a lot of books set in Italy, and it's very funny because they're always somebody says to me at some point when we're talking about the book, it's like, it made me want to book a trip there. We had a book set in Rome last year called When in Rome by Liam Callanan, where apparently the editor went to Rome after editing the book. So this is set in Venice, and it's specifically about the glassmakers of Murano, which are right outside of Venice. Tracy Chevalier is known for historical fiction, and she's also known for highlighting the work of women in history, from Girls with a Pearl Earring, the unknown character, to Remarkable Creatures, which was about two early women who classified fossils. So this book is about, it comes with some problems because she wanted to tell the story over 500 years. So that's a problem because you'd have like 20 families, you know, you'd have to go through 20 generations of people and you wouldn't remember who anybody was. So she does one little twist, which is almost speculative. And, you know, speculative ideas are, you know, they're obviously fantasy and science fiction is hugely popular now. We're seeing more and more speculative ideas creep into literary fiction, into mysteries, into romance. So why not into historical fiction? So what she does is you follow one family, the Rossos, over the 500 years, the whole world is changing. Everybody's getting older and dying. But the people around them in this, it's literally the town where time stood still. And glassmaking was a slow industry to change. So it makes perfect sense. I thought it was delightful. You just have to go with it. And they deal with everything. Casanova, Napoleon, ecological disasters, tourism, the rise of manufacturing in China. I mean, everything that they have to deal with. But the key is, and this was she did a ton of research for the book. And the thing that really inspired her was, for the most part, the glassmakers were men, especially working at the furnaces, you know, making the goblets and platters and stuff. But the beads were made over lamps. And that's where the women really were able to create.
Where they shone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds fascinating. And you're going to stay in, we stay in Italy for book two, which is the Sicilian Inheritance.
Yeah, we just take a train, I think, and maybe a boat. I've heard the train service in Italy, so this is I'm really living vicariously as people tell me, the train service is way better than you expect it to be. Much better than France. I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm overhearing conversations. So Sicilian Inheritance is a super summer read. It is about a woman butcher in Philadelphia, an upscale butcher, who her great aunt dies and leaves her this request to spread her ashes in Sicily, where they're from. And as she's leaving, she gets one more note from her late aunt. By the way, find out if my sister was murdered. So this is about the women who were left behind when families migrated. I don't know if you know this, but in the metro Milwaukee, at least, there's a huge group of people who are from Sicily. Probably more people from Sicily, Italian-Americans, than any other part of Italy.
Oh.
And so this is a very popular idea. And so this book is what I call, and you'll see hear about it in other books too, a book club-friendly dual narrative timeline. So we have Sarah, the butcher, writing about Serafina, her great-grandmother, and the story jumps from one to the other. Was Serafina murdered because she was a witch? Was it the mob? We don't know. It's like it's historical fiction with a lot of research, but it's also a mystery and it's also a romance. It's really fun.
So a lot. And Joe Piazza.
Joe Piazza, who's written a lot of... She writes so many different kinds of books. She wrote a couple of books with Christine Pride. She's written nonfiction about nuns. She was a journalist for many years. One of the things that I always laugh about is that, you know, she's got books in the double digits, but it's hard to have a track record because every book of hers is so different. I enjoyed this one a lot.
Daniel Golden, our guest, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. We're talking, we're going through his list of great summer reads. He's got 20 of them. We're going around, kind of around the world, as the books are set in different places around the world, and that's always kind of fun, all the way, and including in the world is Wisconsin. We'll get to those later on.
We zero in on the place that really counts, right?
But here we are coming up next. We are in Germany.
And yes.
This sounds much more serious, maybe?
It is. So this is the problem when you're doing it geographically, is they don't always match up thematically. And so this is classic narrative nonfiction for folks who like Patrick Radden Keefe or David Gran or even Eric Larson. Jacob Kushner is the author. He's a journalist. Until recently, he was based in Nairobi. And he had heard about this story for many years and just assumed somebody would eventually write a book about it, but nobody did. So he said, I'm going to write it myself. This is about a gang of white supremacists, ragtag, you'd almost say, white supremacists for over 10 years went on a spree of murdering Muslim immigrants, mostly Muslim immigrants.
Boy.
And they would raise their money by robbing banks around the country on motorbikes in little plastic masks. I mean, like you would think, how could they not be caught on motorbikes?
Yeah.
But they not only were escape detection, but were in some way supported by the German government, because the German government had the system of informers. They would find right-wing people to inform on their colleagues, but they would supply them with money as a cover. So they didn't really do a great job of informing. They really perpetuated things as much as anything else. It's a very interesting book. Plenty of crime, if you like your true crime, but also historical narrative. I think that perhaps the book doesn't get as much attention because this is the kind of thing we like to hear about in the United States, you know, the, all the terrible things. But this is a very important thing because here's a country that's done such a good job of dealing with their past, and they still have issues with this, and especially with the reunification afterwards.
Well, we are on our way to France next, and this book was influenced by World War II.
That's interesting you say that because her last book, The Paris Library, that was World War II. And that was about the American Library in Paris and how they were shut down by the Germans, but still able to supply books. So this goes back, Janet Skeslien Charles, who lives, she's from, I think, Montana, but she lives full time in Paris for many, many years. While she was doing research for that book, she came across Jesse Carson, who was an American librarian who was sent by Anne Morgan, J.P. Morgan's daughter, to help rebuild Paris after World War I. Anne Morgan had this group called the Cards, and they were mostly socialites who would do good work in the fields. And I don't know how she got them to do it. None of them were paid. Anne Carson was paid. She really wanted a trained librarian. And Anne Carson actually brought children's libraries to Paris, to France, because they didn't really think that kids needed their own libraries. This is classic historical fiction. No speculative aspect. But there is the dual timeline. So she's got a contemporary librarian doing the research, and it goes back and forth between the contemporary librarian and Jesse Carson. The women are amazing. The backstory is terrific. Most of the historical characters are real people. Some were high, you know, composites, as you find, you have to accept that in historical fiction.
You know, I'm thinking about this. It seems to me that there have been a number of books either about libraries or librarians or bookstores.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's because they have an audience that's willing to hand sell the books. But also, book lovers love libraries and bookstores. Yeah. Yeah. And so there's no question, if you talk to, you know, there's some people who don't, but there's a lot of my customers and at customers at independent bookstores and even Barnes and Noble and you know, other bookstores that just love bookstores. And so when they see something called, you know, the Little Madrid bookstore, that hasn't come out yet, but when it comes, it's going to do pretty well.
Daniel Golden, our guest today, we're going through his 20 picks books for summer reading. If you have a suggestion or maybe a question, I hope you'll join in. What's on your reading list? Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. So what's on your summer reading list for books? Maybe you'll pick one of the 20 that Daniel Golden has selected for us. Daniel, of course, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and he's put together a sort of around-the-world look at new books that are out, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call with your own ideas or questions, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Well, we were in France to hear about Miss Morgan's Book Brigade, and now we're going to Sipsworth in, I believe.
It's in England, yeah.
Yeah, it's in England, yeah.
So it's just a Chunnel thing, Chunnel was built.
You really like this book.
I do really like this book. I really love the author, Simon Van Boy. One of my favorite books of all time is a book called The Illusion of Separateness. He is so good at kind of tugging at your heart in a sophisticated, non-schmaltzy sort of way. And so this is a story about an older woman who has lost her husband and son. So it is, there's a lot of grief in the story. And she's basically gone back to the town where she grew up pretty much to die. And she's really isolated from the community. And it is nothing less than a mouse. And it's not an anthropomorphized mouse. And no, there's no chapter from the perspective of the mouse, but it is a mouse that brings her back into community. I love stories about people reconnecting. So do lots of people, you know, Man Called Uva and that kind of thing. And it's a beautiful book. But what what I'm going to tell you is I had so much support because our buyer manager, Jason, meets with other bookstores around the country every 6 months, and they all like to talk about what they're reading. And he wrote back to me and said, everybody's talking about Sipsworth. Everybody's talking about it. And he said, did you read this? Because I know you like Simon Van Boy. So I sent him back my staff rec, you know, like, yes, I read it. And it's been selling well off our shelf. It's from a very independent publisher called David Godine. So they don't have the resources that the large publishers do. Nobody's going to pick them for the national book clubs or anything.
Yeah.
It's a quiet book, but, it's just emotionally fulfilling, light, gentle humor. And you know, the mice as the sub-hero is sort of underrated, you know?
So it's Sipsworth.
Sipsworth, yes. The name of the mouse.
Mm-hmm. Sipsworth. You know, I read you were talking about does the creature talk or is it in the creature's mind or that sort of thing. And I did read just recently, last month or two, I read Remarkably Bright Creatures, which came out in 2022.
2 years ago, that's right.
And it was a bestseller then.
And it's a bestseller now.
And it's come back, you know, the kind of drop down, but now it's a bestseller again, and it's about an octopus. And it's the mind of the octopus is paramount in this book.
I think it is a found family story. I'm positive we once talked about it. It's 50 or 60 books ago. But we were big fans when the book came out. And I have to say, you know, I really love the book. It's about, you know, an older person finding, you know, it is a grief book. It's a found family book. And it's a connection book. But you're right. It's what takes it to the next level is that octopus. Because some of the chapters are from the perspective of the octopus. It's got a mystery. Is well wrapped into it. I have a book. I don't want to go out of order, but I have a book to recommend for people who, should I do it now? Should I jump?
Sure, which one?
So it's a book called How to Read a Book. And it should be the book set in Maine. And I read this book, and I read one of her books 20 years ago called Any Bitter Thing and loved it, and all my bookseller friends loved it, and then she wrote a few more books I didn't read, then read a memoir that I liked, but I didn't know, you know, it was just as the store was opening. And so then I really literally read this book because I thought, oh, well, how to read a book. That sounds interesting, but it's a novel. It's not a how-to book. And also I thought Monica Wood, I really liked her book 20 years ago. And so it is set in Portland and starts in a prison book club. And the coordinator of the book is a retired English teacher. And they spend several chapters of the book reading classics and with the women in the group. And one of the women has gone to prison for manslaughter. She was OWI and someone was killed. And they are not really supposed to, you know, for the protection of the book club coordinator, they're not really supposed to give personal information. They're not really supposed to know who each other is. But when this woman gets out, they run into each other at a bookstore. But also in the bookstore, one of the booksellers who's also the handyman is the husband of the woman who died.
Oh.
So you can imagine, and they all connect. And this seems like there's a lot of things can possibly go wrong, but it winds up being a story of connection and found family. And here's the thing. I thought that alone reminded me of Remarkably Bright Creatures, of a story about grief, a story about, you know, about misjudgments about people. But one of the things that happens is she goes to work in a parrot lab and becomes very, very attached to the parrot. Now, the parrot doesn't get their own chapter, but the parrot is very intelligent. And Monica Wood based all the work on the parrot who comes into the plot based on real research and a real parrot lab. And so if you like the animal stuff, the parrot stuff's really interesting. So that's how to read a book.
And then the other book we were just talking about was Sipsworth.
Sipsworth. And then, of course, it all came together through Remarkably Bright Creatures.
Clyde in Fond du Lac, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, Larry.
Hello.
I have a book that is sort of related to our political year and all of that. It's called How Democracies Die, and I think it would be a great book for everyone to read before they go to the election.
How Democracies Die. All right.
Is that the book by Stephen Levitsky from about 5 years ago?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. It there are a number of books that have been kind of looking at that that subject recently. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it came out then, but not that, you know, obviously anything post 2016 was thinking about that. Still timely.
How Democracies Die. Thanks, Clyde. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And we've been mentioning the titles a couple of times, but I'm sure that Jill is going to have the complete listing of the titles up on our page, the ideas at WPR, talk@WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date and click in the comments and you're going to get to that list for sure. Let's see, we're leaving Europe now and heading to Asia. And the first book you have from that area is The Lion Women of Tehran.
Yes, Marjane Kamali wrote a book called The Stationery Shop that came out during COVID, and actually I think before COVID, but the paperback was during COVID, and I really wanted to read it. I'd heard really wonderful things about it. It is about separated lovers over many years. And the stationery shop sells books, so, you know, could have been a bookstore. And so when this book came along, something about the time, you know, everybody knows this when they're in a library or bookstore or browsing a website. Sometimes they don't know why they pick something, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it just happens. And I guess somebody had mentioned something to me, so I said, oh, I found the book. I'm going to read it. And it is a lovely novel of friendship over 70 years. A relatively wealthy family, the father dies, and the mother and daughter move to a poor part of Tehran, where Ellie meets Homa, who is a much poorer girl. Yeah. But her family is sort of rich in connection. And so she sort of sees the gifts that her friend has, too. They wind up going to school together for a while, bond, and then her mother remarries and she moves back to the wealthy part of town. And then after that, it's a series of connections and betrayals and upheavals in government. As you know, yeah. Iran has gone through many changes since the 1950s. But all along, they wind up having to connect again when Homa gets in trouble with the government. And this book reminded me, believe it or not, I mean, I know it's not the erudite level of Elena Ferrante in terms of the intellectuals, but it reminded me of that. Like two very different women, a friendship over a long course. It was very interesting. I always like reading about different places, you mm-hmm. can see from the list. And I don't really know much about what life was like in Tehran, even though I have several Iranian or Persian customers who sometimes talk to me about it. And I thought it was a wonderful book. Great for historical fiction fans. And if you want a really wonderful friendship novel, I think this is it.
And it's called The Lion Women of Lion, as in L-I-O-N, Lion Women of Tehran. Mm-hmm. Tehran. That sounds interesting. Boy, they're all sounding interesting to me. Is the next one, Jill thought the next one, just based on the title, might be a comedy. It's titled The Perfect Couple.
It's a thriller.
It's a thriller.
Holy moly. Ruth Ware has broke on the scene, I don't know, about 10 years ago. And after, you know, coming from nowhere and writing one bestseller after another, this is a thriller. They always compare her to Agatha Christie, and I don't know what it is. Like, you're a British writer, you're a woman, you must be the next Agatha Christie. We can't think of any other British mystery writers. But this is definitely more of a thriller than a mystery. It is a combination of, it starts out as a reality show, like a Temptation Island, Love Island, where, you know, five couples are going to go to this island and compete, and they'll break the partnerships up, and there'll be a winner who'll get a bunch of prizes. And our heroine is a scientist, but her boyfriend is a struggling actor, and he decides this is going to be his big break, so he wants all the publicity, so he convinces her to go on. She really doesn't want to do this, and unfortunately they have been put in a situation where they all could very well die. and on top of that, she winds up doing a little better than she thought in the competition. So the way I put it is, they said, oh, it's like And Then There Were None, because a bunch of people die. No, I don't think so. It's Love Island meets, what did I say it was? A Lord of the Flies.
Oh, boy.
Because meets on the Fire Festival. Do you remember the Fire Festival? Mm-hmm. Island retreat festival where everything went wrong and everything was shoddy and it was a complete mess. Well, that's what this is like. She has a good sense of humor about it, but it's definitely a survival thriller.
That sounds great. I was trying to think. Blair Braverman's book.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the title. Oh, my goodness. Which is kind of set in the Midwest, where she is in a contest, and
is that Small Game?
Small Game, yes, Small Game. I interviewed Blair about her book, and it's a contest, and it turns into survival.
A nightmare.
Yeah.
Those are fun. I mean, because you do think about a lot of these contests, and you think, this could go terribly wrong. I mean, think about Survivor. What happens if they lose internet? Let alone, you know, there's a natural disaster. Holy moly.
Oh, man. Daniel Golden, we're talking about his 20 books that he is recommending for summer reading. If you have a recommendation or maybe just a question about a book, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We were just talking about the book titled The Perfect Couple by Ruth Ware. And now book eight tells us the story of a Chinese immigrant. What kind of a story is this?
So it's a generational saga, a classic kind of subgenre of a subgenre, I guess you'd say. And I read a lot of books about Chinese culture. I'm just very interested in it. But this was a very different kind of twist. It's three generations: a Chinese immigrant, her first gen daughter, and her biracial daughter or the grandson. And but there's a secret, and it has to do with the very, very wealthy science industrialist that the daughter, Lily, winds up marrying. And it all goes back to the Cultural Revolution, where her mother was a scientist in China, where she was experimenting with lotus seeds. This is such a good book. I love when this happens. We've had five people read it in the store who all loved it. They even loved it enough to like write up rec cards and write recommendations for it. She's a wonderful writer. It's got such a broad canvas, and she approaches in a different way. I have recommended in the past other books that touched on the Cultural Revolution, which is for many ways for Chinese Americans, sort of like that touchstone moment, like in other cultures, like the terrible thing they had to live through. But the difference is, if you're in China, if you're a Chinese writer, you really can't talk about it the way you can. One was called Swimming Back to Trout River. Another was called A Map for the Missing, both really wonderful books. But this is a very different take. I also love that it's, like I said, it's a family saga, but the stories are not told in order, so you have to piece it together. Very, very rewarding. I went back and read, I liked this so much, I went back and read her first book, Goodbye Vitamin, which has some similar themes, but is a much more spare, kind of quirky, humorous, feels like a first novel. So,
and this one, again, the title is Real Americans.
Yes, and you'll find after you read the book, you're like, oh, that's a really good title.
Real Americans by Rachel Kong. Well, let's see. The next book is one you chose, set in New Zealand. Kind of an unusual, you know, how many books are set in New Zealand?
That's why I wanted to talk about it. So maybe.
Is that right?
Well, maybe a little. But actually, I thought the place was very distinctive. This is my only book that's a reprint, like it's in paperback now.
It's Burnham Wood.
Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. We, you know, I always ask you when I visit you how your book club is going. Mm-hmm. I know you really love the Alex Pickett Restaurant Inspector, and we were talking about some of your upcoming books, which I was all writing down to make sure I had them. And this is one that my book club read, and we have a book club recommendation table, and I get 20 or so people that I get to test the book on. We did have a bookseller who really loved it. It's an eco-thriller. It did pretty well. It was the follow-up to a Booker Prize winner called Luminaries. But this is a very big change of pace, and you weren't going to necessarily get all those people who read the prize winner. So it is set in New Zealand. There is a terrible landslide after an earthquake, and a bunch of people die, and this big patch of land that was a longtime farm is sort of cut off, and a group of anarchist, I would say, gardeners called Burnham Wood decide, oh, that would be a great place for us to do our gardening, you know, where they go onto public land or land that isn't being used.
Yeah.
And they garden and they give the stuff away, or they sell it, or to raise money or something like that. But what they don't know is there's also this billionaire drone manufacturer who's planning to build a bunker there. And what they also don't know is that the people who own, what they do, the owners of the land are this pest control company who is has this weird environmental environmental quest to save this rare bird. But let me just say, nobody is really what, like, everybody is compromised and everybody's hiding secrets from each other. And this is not going to go well. It is a really interesting book because the drones sort of play out the themes of the book, which are surveillance and recalibrating, you know, the way of like you over there and the zone's got to redo where they are. And this is everybody's behavior. They're constantly trying to outthink what the other people are doing and reset. Let me also say Burnham Wood is from Macbeth. And so there is definitely Macbeth connections in the book. They are all little Macbeths looking for domination. The book is, let me just say, it is a thriller. There's a terrible gut punch. Like, there's a certain point in the book you go, ugh, I can't read anymore. But you just have to sleep it off and maybe you'll be better the next day. You can appreciate it.
Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. All right. Well, back in the U.S. now, and we have our kids' pick.
That's right. One kid book. I read, I've said this before, I try to read one middle grade book a month. I just read my first Kate DiCamillo because I was shamed by fellow booksellers for not having read Kate DiCamillo. But I do get to read new books too. And this is a book that came out this spring. Now I got to say, yeah, I'm reading some thrillers. I'm reading some stories. But you can tell I like the emotional, gut-wrenching, heartfelt stories. I am of a type, I would say. And so this is kind of a kid's take on some of those other books I talked about. So you've got a family in San Francisco.
Hey, wait a minute. It's titled Olivetti.
Olivetti by
Like the
Allie
Typewriter.
Yes, Like the Typewriter. And it is about a family. The mother disappears. The boy is left wondering what happened to her. Also, her typewriter disappears. So it is a mystery. Like, what? Why did my mom leave? Was she taken? What, you know, was it something I did? What happened to the family? So he's going to solve this mystery. He actually finds out what happened to the typewriter because he finds it in a pawn shop. And the young girl whose family has the pawn shop helps him try to solve it because it turns out the typewriter has the secrets. So, you know how we were talking about the octopus telling the story? There's a whole thing in kids fiction where, like, objects that maybe wouldn't normally tell a story,
Yeah.
Wish Tree by Catherine Applegate, which is a very popular, now often banned book about a sentient tree who tells part of the story. And then there's a book called The Rover Story about a sentient Mars rover who tells part of the story. So this typewriter, let me just say, can't talk, but can type some interesting stuff. So I really enjoyed it, and I would compare it to people who like Wish Tree or Catherine Applegate's Crenshaw or something like that.
You wonder if kids even know what a typewriter is these days.
Well, you know, there is. It's like vinyl records and physical books. You know, these things come back. Even 8-track, you know, even cassette tapes. You know, there's a typewriter festival in Milwaukee, or we had one last year. And there's you'd be surprised. And if they're not, like, we've had typewriter collectors. I would guess they do sell typewriters still, you know? And so maybe if a kid is exposed to it, maybe a kid will say, I would like to be more interested in typewriters. Or maybe they'll say, what the heck is this, Mom and Dad? Could go either way. Thank you for noticing.
Daniel Golden, our guest, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. It's great to have him with us for his list, 20 Summer Reads. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts or comments as we move along. Do you have a book that you've read recently that you think others should read? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. It's great to have him with us, and we're talking about his 20 books that he's recommending for summer reading. Questions of your own or maybe a suggestion to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. So our next book, we're going to go out west.
Way of Ireland, yes. Ireland and Montana.
Yeah.
So this is, you know,
it's called The Heart of...
Heart in Winter by Kevin Barry. Yeah.
Okay.
And this is, I realized I must once again apologize that arranging the books geographically has made things like an emotional roller coaster. I go from, oh, this is light and sweet. Oh, this is everyone dies in this one. Oh, you know. So this is a beautifully bawdy book about the American West. And Kevin Barry has written up until now, all his books have been set in Ireland. I actually read his short story collection during COVID when we were doing virtual events. And this is one of those books. And then I liked that so much, I went back and read Nightboat to Tangier, which was a New York Times top 10 of the year. And this is one of those cases, which has happened occasionally with us, where the virtual event was so successful that we got on the tour for the book when it came out. He's every book on this list is either out or will be out by early July. Okay. I felt like if it went later than early July, then it wasn't maybe just an early fall book. So this is set in Montana, and it's in a mining camp. And one of the miners who is drunk and on high and whatever, and is all around a kind of a difficult worker, falls in love with the manager's new mail order bride. So needless to say, things do not go well. They are they have deliriously sloppy relations, and then they are sent on the run where they're heading for California. There's almost a little Bonnie and Clyde-ness about it. But it is a beautiful book. It's just the language is this is the thing. Everybody actually in the book is Celtic. You know, if they're not Irish, then they're Cornish or something. And it's a short book. I passed it on to my friends at Celtic Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And my reader there loved the book as well. Our event manager, Chris, is a more sophisticated reader than I am, can I just say? Loved it as well. This is one of those books where we overlapped. And I'm just really excited for it because I think these books were... I know Sebastian Barry, who's another wonderful Irish writer. I remember when he wrote his first book in the United States, and it's a bit of a miss because sometimes the Irish press, which is so important in these Irish books, by the way, you know, aren't as excited by it. But I think they're going to like it. I think so.
Jill was wondering if it might appeal to those who like Westerns.
Oh, it's got almost a Cormac McCarthy vibe to it. So not all Westerns, you know, not necessarily... the more commercial Westerns, but the literary ones, like I said, I would cross this. I have a bookseller who reads mostly books that are 100 years old, but also Cormac McCarthy. And I think we're going to try. We'll see if we can make it, get him to read it.
Mark emailed to recommend a nonfiction educational book called Too Dark 30. Two as in T-W-O. Too Dark 30 includes true stories from teachers to help those who find themselves also pursuing teaching careers. So Mark may be a teacher himself.
Mark Hill might be the writer. But yes, Too Dark 30, true stories to inspire teaching and learning in our local heroes. Very nice.
All right. Well, here we go to... New York City, if I'm not mistaken. New York City?
Yeah, I jumped a little. I wanted to end in Wisconsin, so I had to do at least one cross-country trip to make that work. So there's a, you know what?
And this one is titled When Women Ran Fifth Avenue.
Right. And so one of the things I've always said about publishing is it's mostly based in New York. And so when they write books about other cities, they're like, well, this is a little regional. Maybe we wouldn't buy this book. But oddly enough, when there used to be presses in Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago and San Francisco, there still are, but not as many. They would be the ones. All the Red Sox books were published by Houghton Mifflin and Little Brown when they were based in Boston. But fortunately, New York, there are still some wonderful stories set in New York. And this book has been selling pretty well for us, had a nice New York Times feature. And it really is about three groundbreaking women of retail. Back when we think about retail as being a woman's field, but in the day, the leaders were all men. And the three stores were, and you got to be a little older to even know what they are, Bonwit Teller, Henry Bendel, and Lorden Taylor were the three leaders. Now, let me just say, things did not always go well for them because they were the leaders. They were not the owners. They didn't really have the full power. So, for example, the woman who was the head of Bonwit Teller was actually the basis for Mary Haynes and the women, Do you remember that movie?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's even the man who ran the salon where this all happened wrote his memoir and told the story about how the woman who did the nails stole the Bonwit Teller head's husband. But Lord and Taylor was probably the happiest story. Henry Bendel was a very sophisticated store for a very certain kind of clientele that was then sort of bought out by Leslie Wexner of The Limited and sort of run into the ground. But a lot of these stores, you know, it was really hard to continue the momentum. Really, the true heroine, the real titan of retail in the 20th century, was a woman named Beatrice Fox Auerbach, who ran a department store called G. Fox & Company, and she was the model for one of the women in Mad Men.
Oh.
And she was incredibly successful because she actually owned the store because she inherited it from her father. But why didn't she get a full book? Because it was set in, the store was in Hartford, not in New York City. So,
but, you know, there are times when there are breakthroughs. I'm thinking of Michael Perry. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a regional book. His first book, which now suddenly the title is escaping.
Population 485, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Population. You know, it was, you know, set in the middle of Wisconsin, but it had a lot of appeal nationwide.
It did. As the books went on, though, I think he had a little more struggle breaking out.
Yeah.
I think we're sometimes seen as an oddity. I will tell you, the first time I was in Queens, New York, in a very kind of urban, you know, progressive bookstore, and I found a staff rec card for Shotgun Love Songs by Nick Butler, and I almost screamed. I'm like, what the heck is this doing here? It made me so happy. So it does, you're right, it does happen. And Wisconsin, sometimes becomes the star of the show. I mean, you know, we all get our Top Chef season, right? And but it's hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. Well, we did mention earlier Cape Cod, or Sandwich, I should say. It's set in Cape Cod, but maybe I don't know that we mentioned the name of it again before. So let's do it again. Sandwich. By Catherine Newman.
Yes, everybody, Sandwich.
It's set in a summer getaway spot.
It's a summer getaway spot. I believe it's over the course of one family's vacation in Sandwich, Massachusetts. And it is one of the two books I talk about that I would have grouped them together if it worked well on my road trip, but they're a little separate. And I call them midlife meltdown novels. So this is a woman who is dealing with the struggles of her just adult children, one leaving for college, one getting married, and her parents who come to visit in this home that they've been, you know, vacation home they've been staying at for years and years and years. Oh my gosh, Catherine Newman's voice is amazing. She is funny. She's going through menopause during the book. Everything that can go wrong can. She is philosophical. She's wise. She's perceptive about human nature. And I will say that everyone who reads this book or her first book wants to read another book. So I went back after reading this book and read her first book, which was called We All Want Impossible Things, which is about a woman whose best friend is in a hospice for cancer. And very similar voice. Very simple, like a bigger than life voice. And people just adore this book. They haven't exploded nationally, but I think the way I see people reacting to these books, I think someday she's going to hit the right person and explode. This book hasn't come out yet, but it's not coming out the right week. We don't know what the book club books are. Sometimes they secretly confide in us. We're not supposed to tell anyone. But to my knowledge, this is coming out the wrong week to be one of the National Book Club selections. But I thought it was terrific. And as I mentioned, Chris who, like I said, he said, this is a book I wouldn't normally read, but I loved it too. And I also love to say, I love books with multiple meanings in the titles. So it's in Sandwich, Massachusetts. It's a sandwich generation, and they also eat a lot of sandwiches. So.
Daniel Golden will be with us until 12:30 today. Great to have him along, and you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Having a fun talk today with Daniel Golden about his summer book list. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Daniel is the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. He's got a great list for us and love to hear from you as well. What's your favorite type of summer read? Favorite book to recommend? Give a call. Number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And we got somebody on the road between Wausau and Marshfield, Twinkie. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I just happened to get in my van to head to my next appointment and had the radio on, as I always do, and there you were, and there you were talking about books and asking for recommendations, and I do have one.
And what is that recommendation?
It's a book titled Made for You. And it is on pre-order right now on Amazon. And it is, I've had the privilege of doing a read before publication, and it is amazing. It's a book about a synthetic woman who wins The Bachelor on the program. But then he comes up dead, and it's just thrilling, especially given, you know, all the generative AI that's in the news these days. It's a great read. You got to get it.
And who's the author?
The author is Jenna, J-E-N-N-A, Satterthwaite. I'll spell the last name for you because it's kind of long. S-A-T-T-E-R-T-H-W-A-I-T-E.
All right. Thank you very much. Are you familiar with that book?
The list called it Tense and Thrilling. So it sounds like our caller would agree with that.
Made for you. Thanks very much for tuning in while you're on the road. Appreciate it very much. Made for you. Well, Sarah in White Lake, Wisconsin has a recommendation, I believe, as well. Let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Daniel. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, so I'm actually on the road as well between White Lake and Oshkosh and was listening to the radio and actually voicing some notes on some of the recommendations that you gave and thought I would give a call. So these are young adult adventure books, like fantasy books. They're not my usual read, but I had mentioned that I am in a master's program and just needed a break from some heavy reading, and these were recommended. So the series is actually called Project Phoenix, and the author is Sophia Wachtel, W-A-C-H-T-E-L. They are actually her first two books that she's ever written, and they are amazing. The first title in the series is called Kingdom of Feather and Sky. And the second one is Daughter of Darkness, and she has a third coming out. It is a story that surrounds a fantasy kingdom called the Kingdom of Kalmora, and Princess Kira is the main stage character. Sophia's characters are developed very deeply. The story itself is surrounding the fact that she is a part of this political kingdom, and her parents are very mysterious in the way they lead their kingdom, very selfish in the way they lead their kingdom. Princess Kira has always been not enough, and her brother Derek, who has passed away, has always been the best in her parents' eye, and she can't live up to him. But then it comes out that there's something mysterious about Derek's death, and Kira starts to investigate that, and it develops into quite an adventure story with relationships and danger, and the second book follows that very well.
Well, thank you so much. So the Project Phoenix series, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I see it over here. So what's been interesting about it, doesn't, you know, it doesn't really have bookstore distribution like so many other mm-hmm. books nowadays. It's meant to be sold online. That we can get it for customers, but it's, you know, it's bookstore mumbo jumbo, you know, like short discount, non-returnable, da da da. What's interesting about a lot of these programs is that a lot of books like in the genre do start out nowadays with people publishing themselves or through small, you know, partner companies.
Yeah.
But many of them go on to sales at the larger companies and get more distribution. The other thing, though, we're seeing with a lot of the YA fantasy, which I think you'd call it, is it's aging up. And a lot of several series now started as YA series and have moved to adult fantasy. Sarah J. Maas is the most famous, where they actually took the whole series and repackaged it for adults. There's a lot more freedom to write whatever you want. I think YA books, especially from the larger publishers, have a lot of rules about what you can and can't do. And also that customer is aging up a bit. So
yeah.
If Sophia finds success, you might find that one day these books are published as adult novels.
Deborah in Wisconsin Rapids will give you a chance. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. The book I recommend highly for grandparents and kids and moms and dads is Love You Forever by Robert Munsch. It's kind of old, but it's a goodie. A keeper.
A keeper. Robert Munsch.
Still sells in bookstores, yeah.
Love You Forever.
Mm-hmm. It is, about 40 years old. It's almost 40 years old.
And still sells.
It still sells, that's right.
Ah. I'll be. Deborah, thank you so much. Appreciate that suggestion as well. Well, let's see. Here we are. We're getting closer to Wisconsin, I think. Is that where we are next, in Illinois?
No, we're in Minnesota.
Oh, we're in
Minnesota. We detoured. Oh, my God. Wrong way. So the book I was recommending, it's almost, as I said, it's like Bayfield adjacent, you know. So it's the new Leif Enger, who is most famous for a book called Peace Like a River. And then... has two other books. We did very, very well with Virgil Wander, which was a story about community set at a movie theater in a small town in Minnesota. This is, people will know Leif from his books about very dynamic heroes and books about community. This is a dystopian novel. Things have deteriorated in the United States, but in this small town on the Lake Superior shore, Rainey, I believe, who is the hero, and his wife live in a small town and are pretty much able to make do. But the awful parts of the world outside kind of crash into their lives when they harbor a fugitive on the run from a big corporate overlord, and leads Rainey on an Odyssean chase through Lake Superior. It is, like I said, it's got a lot of the elements, both the environmental catastrophe and the political catastrophe of dystopian novels, but it is written with Leif Enger's warmth and heart. It's been a big, popular with booksellers around the country. Also got actually a spectacular Wall Street Journal review, so it's had a number of fans, and that is called I Cheerfully Refuse.
Speaking of the Superior, you and I were talking before the show about Wendy Webb's book, The Haunting of Bryn Wilder. I was in Bayfield and about 2 weeks ago now, for Bayfield in Bloom. And this book is, although it doesn't say it's set in Bayfield, it is set in Bayfield. And it was, so I bought it when I was in Bayfield. I had a lot of fun reading it. You know, it's lost, love, community, ghosts.
She likes ghosts, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was really a lot of fun. It was The Haunting of Bryn Wilder and Wendy Webb, the author.
She's got about seven more books for you to read.
I know.
You can be, you can have, get rid of your other book club. You can have a Wendy Webb book club. Because I've known people over the years who've read her books and really enjoyed them. And so I would say if you like this one. Now, there was a restaurant that you bought. Did you buy it at the restaurant?
Actually, it was at Greinke's restaurant is where, and I think Greinke's has some rooms upstairs where they rent out. And we happened to eat at Greinke's restaurant, and Greinke's restaurant was selling copies of the book.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Very, very fun. Well, now we're going to Illinois. I think Claire Lombardo has a book titled Same as It Ever Was.
Yes. This is part two of Midlife Meltdown, another series for you. And this is Claire Lombardo's second novel. Her first book, The Most Fun We Ever Had, was actually just recently picked as one of the big book club selections in paperback, which is very unusual. They usually do them. They want to be first. They want to do it as the book kind of is released in hardcover. So, but because somebody read the book on the team, or maybe it was Reese, she got picked late as a book club pick. The new book is set in the Chicago suburbs. Very much, if you know Chicago, you'll recognize a lot of the setting, and it is a book about a woman who is planning a wedding and runs into an old neighbor, an older woman that she had become very close friends to, that had to rupture that friendship and because of a terrible mistake that she made, the heroine made. And her name is Julia, and it's a terrible lapse in judgment, and she has to come to terms with that before she makes another terrible lapse in judgment. So while she's juggling her two kids, her husband, and any other number of things, it is once again a kind of a character study. It is very well written. I can't tell you, the one of the women who called in talked about being an early reader. We talk to a lot of early readers. They're bookstagrammers and TikTok influencers. And we'll look at the reviews on that website that people can write things on early. And there's been a lot of big love for this book. And we're excited for it to come out. So
let's go to Aaron in Madison. Aaron has one for us. Thanks for calling, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to make such a wonderful recommendation. I'm a hairdresser in Madison, Wisconsin, and I have a lovely client of mine who is a Wisconsin local author. She moved here from India with her family, and the book is called The Lucky Ones. It's by Zara Chowardy. It's actually a memoir from when she was 16 years old, living in one of the fastest growing cities in India. And it's about the intersectionality between freedom, religious freedom, and a story about her family's survival during a really tumultuous time back in 2002. She's a writer and lecturer.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting to me. And here's a local story, The Lucky Ones.
We're hosting her in August.
Oh, you are? Oh, Aaron, you called at the right time. So you're hosting.
I haven't read the book yet. I just got an advanced copy. But, you know, it's dealing with the discrimination against women and Muslims in India.
Aaron, thank you so much. The Lucky Ones. Appreciate that as well. And in August. Is this an online one or is this?
We might record it because usually we record about one a week and then replay them. This way we can edit out the messy bits.
Understood. Understood. Well, number 17 is set in Wisconsin, and the author is Andrew Graff, who we've had on the show for his earlier novel, True North. This one is Raft of Stars.
Did I get that right? I think the first one was Raft of Stars.
I'm sorry.
This one's True North.
Backwards. Yes.
I think. So, interestingly
enough.
True
North was the original.
Right. True North is. Wow, I'm so confused. In any case.
Andrew Graff has two books, True North and Raft of Stars.
Which is. So, this book is about rafting.
Yes. So was the first one.
Yes. So we know. So it's about a couple who stake everything to buy a rafting company. His job's in danger. Their kids are going to have to be uprooted. And he takes over his uncle's rafting business. Only what he doesn't know is another deep-pocketed outfit has come to town to kind of grab the business away. At the same time, somebody's trying to grab the land for mining. And so it is about sort of a couple at the brink, and it's very exciting. And what I wanted to say about this book is...
It's True North.
Yeah. You should read it. They're both good.
What did you want to say about this book? You said...
Oh, this is... But this book is about rafting.
Yeah.
That book is more about the kids running away.
Yes.
So it isn't, weirdly enough, the book with raft in the title isn't exactly about raft. Oh, Andrew, what are you doing to us? In any case, this is the kind of book that was meant to be read in the summer. You know, it's like you're on vacation, you're camping at the lake, you're reading a whitewater rafting adventure. They published it in January. So I've got to bring it back.
And by the way, he is going to be on the show to talk about the book, so I'm going to be reading it.
Oh, good. You'll enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, and then we traveled to Milwaukee, I think, for a book that you see as a sort of a contemporary take on Mildred Pierce.
Yes. So no, nobody told me that when I read the book. And it is about a woman who moves, like the Great Migration. She moves from Mississippi to Milwaukee. She follows an aunt. And she starts working in a restaurant that she builds up to be a successful business. But she's left behind her daughter in Mississippi with her ex-husband. And then she finally brings her daughter up, but it doesn't really go well. So they never told me. So I was asking her about some of the complications of the book. And the author said, it's Mildred Pierce. But nobody said it. And I said, oh, like, I understand that creates an idea of where the book is going, but I think that people really like things based on other, you know, movies and books and things, and I think that makes it more of a selling thing. There's definitely, it's an entertaining novel. I would say it's very much kind of captures Black life in Milwaukee. You know, it's got a Terry McMillan vibe for it, but it's when I read a book called Relative Strangers recently by a woman named A.H. Kim, they told me that it was Sense and Sensibility. And they told me that up front. So I'm reading the book and I'm thinking to myself, it doesn't feel like this person she's dating is the person she's going to wind up. So I go to my Jane Austen expert and I say, help me with this book. She said, well, here's how Sense and Sensibility ends. Is there a character like that in the book? And I said, yes, there is. She's like, yeah, I ended the book for you. So, but it didn't end it's kind of fun to see those connections. One of the great things about books going into public domain is that we can have, we can more freely build on those things. We can actually use the characters. I mean, I know when Great Gatsby went into public domain, there must have been 50 different books that were playing with the plot of Great Gatsby. But this book
is titled, by the way, A Taste for More.
Right. A Taste for More by Phyllis Dixon. And it is not, it's a jumping off point. You can't say they didn't steal anything. The copyright police are not allowed to come after this book.
We have a lot of pet lovers on who listen to this show, and you've got
a book that will appeal to them. It's titled Dogland.
Yes, I love books about subculture, and I also love the movie Best in Show. So when I saw this book, I thought, I wonder if this is a serious take on a really interesting subject, which is showing dogs. And it is. And what this guy does, he talks about the history of dog shows, the history of breeding, while he follows this breeder who hopes to have the first Samoyed to win Best in Show at the American Kennel Club. And that actually had a very special place in my heart, because when I was in high school, I had a friend named Robin who bred Samoyeds, and she was so small and the dogs were bigger than her. And I would see her walking around the neighborhood with the dogs, these huge dogs, pulling this tiny little person. And we would talk a lot about dog breeding. So I really enjoyed this book a lot. It's very heartwarming. It really gets at the dog-human relationship. And it has a lot of interesting details too. Now, just to show that I'm not playing sides, it's not officially on the list, but I did actually just finish a book called Catland.
Catland.
So next, I think Birdland, or I guess that's a jazz suite. But this was about an artist named Lewis Wayne, who was in the 1890s to about the 1920s, a very famous artist who drew anthropomorphic cats. And once again, what the writer does is try to show how his success sort of changed the way we felt about cats. At the same time, talks about the rise in cat shows and cat breeding, which went in a very different direction than dogs, partly because it was very hard to keep the cats from breeding.
The last book, but not least, My Life in 17 Books by John Sweeney. My Life in 17 Books.
John is a prolific writer. He lives in Milwaukee. He's a writer, editor, publisher. And I have to say, his last book was about spirituality for cats. That was the most successful book we ever had of his. But this is the one that really spoke to me. And it really is 17 books, from Wendell Berry to a black elk, to Tolstoy, and each book is a jumping off point for something in his life and how the book and his life experience connected together. I just thought it was wonderful for the person who really loves books and loves the life of the mind. This is a terrific book.
And on that note, boy, we're about out of time.
You did it.
We got through all 20 books. It's always a great pleasure. What's the one number one selling book that's flying off your shelves right now?
We're always driven. The thing about books, our sales is the events really drive sales a lot. And so we often, it'll be if we're really working on something. But I would say the Amy Tan, her new book, The Backyard Birdwatcher, is been a huge success for us. Backyard Bird Chronicles.
Yeah.
If you've seen it, it looks like a birding guide. It's actually gotten forward from Sibley, and they bound it just like a bird. And it's got her illustrations, and people have heard her just completely fall in love with her love of birds.
Daniel, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much. You'll come back and do this again with us.
I hope so
too. Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, our guest today. And really, it's always great to have him come. And we're looking forward to his next visit already. And we'll have that list up on ideas at talk@wpr.org under today's date. We'll have the whole list. And coming up, Bassam Shakashiri, our next guest. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We've been talking about summer reading. What goes with summer?
Well, fireworks often go with summer, and our regular guest, Bassam Shakashiri, is back to talk about the science of fireworks. And it's great to have him back. He's an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, known for his leadership in national science policy and promoting excellence in science education at all levels. And he developed the use of demonstrations in teaching chemistry. He's the first holder of the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. So what would you like to know about fireworks and how they're made? Well, have become part of the conversation. We can take other kinds of science issues as well as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always good to be with you, Larry, and with your audience. You provide fabulous opportunities on a variety of topics. It's such a joy to listen to all the conversations, and thank you for including me in this program today. Thank you, Larry.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for being with us. You know, we've got the 4th of July. It's coming up next month, and, of course, that means lots of firework displays. Can you talk about the science behind fireworks?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about the science behind fireworks, but let me start by reminding all of us what the 4th of July is really all about. Yes, we use fire displays to celebrate our independence. It is Independence Day, and it is essential for everyone who is listening. I want to start with you, Larry. I'm going to ask you to make sure you vote this year. It is crucial that we vote, especially as we think about Independence Day. I'll get to the science of fireworks in a second. I'm going to ask everyone in the audience, beginning with Larry, to recruit at least 5 eligible voters who have not voted before to vote in the upcoming primaries and in the general election in November. It's so crucial for us to celebrate our Independence Day by being responsible citizens who care about the quality of life in our society and to truly celebrate the freedom and liberties that we enjoy. Now, so Larry, you
I promise I will do that.
5 new people who have not voted before. Okay, fireworks. We celebrate by, many other communities, we celebrate by setting off fireworks. What are fireworks? They are, they generate a very noticeable form of energy. Well, 3 forms of energy. A tremendous release of sound, light and heat. The tremendous booms that we hear at ground level are the result of the rapid release of energy into the air, causing the air to expand faster than the speed of sound. And this produces a shockwave, a sonic boom. So fireworks are explosions. They are combustion reactions that produce beautiful colors, produce in the form of light, and they produce heat, and they release sound. And so they are pleasing to the eye. They are pleasing to our senses. We enjoy them because they make good connections, visual and audio connections through our brains. And we marvel about the ways by which all of the different components are put together to produce a variety of shapes of fireworks, but they are combustion reactions. They need oxygen from the air to undergo the chemical process, and they are explosions. So an explosion is a chemical reaction that is gone out of control.
How did they create the colors, the different colors?
The colors are produced by heating metal salts such as calcium chloride or sodium nitrate or strontium chloride, and they emit characteristic colors. The atoms in each of the elements absorb energy and then they release it as light of specific colors. I'd like to invite everyone in the audience to visit my website, where I have quite a bit more information about the colors and the different chemicals that are used. So please visit scifun.org, scifun.org. The red color is produced because strontium salts, sometimes lithium salts, are added to the mixture. The orange color comes from calcium salt, like calcium chloride is a substance that's put in there. The yellow color comes from sodium, as we have in sodium chloride, table salt, but use sodium nitrate. Green comes from barium compounds, such as barium chloride. Blue, we see lots of blue. We like the blue color. I like the blue color.
I do, too. Primarily
comes from copper-containing substances. The purple color is a mixture of strontium, which gives us the red color, and the blue color from copper. And sometimes we see bright silvery colors. That's the burning of aluminum or titanium, and sometimes magnesium. And so this is these atoms and these substances are excited, energetically excited, and then they go back to the original state that they were in, and that's when they emit the colors at specific wavelengths.
It's really interesting. You know, there's some growing concern about the environmental impact of fireworks.
Yes.
What kind of damage is done?
Well, we have to be aware of what we enjoy as human beings and the effect on the planet. For one thing, we all know that animals are scared from this sound, from the boom sound, and so we need to be protective of the elements. But the effect of on the environment itself is the addition. We see smoke, of course. We see it's a toxic haze, and it produces what's called particulate matter. This is a combination of minuscule solid and liquid substances that are found in the air. And they are very hazardous because they have a very small diameter. And they can cause harm if we inhale them. So we need to be careful about what gives us visual and pleasure, and what also causes problems for the environment. So these particulate matter substances are fine particles with a diameter, very small diameter, about 2.5 micrometers. Let me give very small. So the average strand of human hair, Larry, is 70 micrometers in diameter, about 30 times larger than the fine particles that have a 2.5 micrometer. And so they can be inhaled and so on. But we have to be aware and stay away. We have to be aware of the hazards and stay away from being so close to fireworks. The professionally produced fireworks are very much enjoyed, and we still have to be careful about the environmental effects that they have. That includes also the fallout from all these metal salts after they're excited and give off light and so on. They fall and they absorb by the soil or by the water. They're also examples of very documented examples on occasions. There's been an increase in the amount of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide at fireworks events. I forgot what it was, but not all that long ago, researchers discovered that when fireworks took place in downtown Minneapolis, the atmospheric concentration of carbon monoxide increased by 32%. And carbon monoxide is poisonous. It's hazardous. Carbon dioxide grew by about 17%. So we just have to be aware of the consequences of everything that we do in life, Larry, including the things that give us pleasure.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison. We talked a bit about fireworks, a bit about voting, and we certainly talked some more about science, I know, and the environment with him. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Bassam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison and first holder of the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. Love to have Bassam with us. And questions for him or comments as we move along, you can join in. Again, the number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. You know, we were talking a bit about the environment. And by the way, are they working to make those fireworks more environmentally friendly?
Yes, there are so-called green fireworks being produced. I don't know at what scale they are being made available. It would be kind of interesting to ask the people who sponsor fireworks, the events, you know, where fireworks are displayed, about the environmental impact. They should be responsible in sharing what information they have about that. I think that behooves us to be asking that question.
Yeah. Well, speaking about the environment, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has hit 420 parts per million. What does that mean for the planet?
This is the highest level that has been recorded, 420 million parts per million. And it is the direct telltale of our dependence and reliance on using fossil fuels as a source of energy, because we burn fossil fuels and they form carbon dioxide, among other products. But the carbon dioxide data, the number that you mentioned, 420 parts per million, it's like a thermometer of the temperature of the planet. We cannot stop global warming. It is inexorable. What we can do is mitigate it. Each one of us has a personal and collective responsibility to slow down our use and reliance and dependence on fossil fuels as a use, as a source of energy. So I'm very pleased, as I'm sure you are, Larry, that hybrid vehicles are now becoming more popular. Electric vehicles are becoming more popular and used not only in the United States, but elsewhere. We have both personal and collective responsibilities to mitigate the spitting out, as I call it, carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and it contributes greatly to increasing the temperature of the planet.
It does indeed. I was just reading some of the electric cars now can get up to, I think, 400 miles on a charge. The science is on batteries has grown almost exponentially.
Both the science and the technologies have been growing very, very rapidly, and all of us should take advantage of the availability of such products for home heating, for transportation, And by the way, Larry, we should also be aware that with more usage of electric vehicles, we have to be concerned about the electric grid and how the power is generated for the electric grid. And all of these situations play well together to help us mitigate global warming, but we all must subscribe and participate on a personal level as well as collectively in our local community, in our state, across the country, around the world, in really protecting our environment. And we use the 420 parts per million, which was recorded very recently, as a telltale of the situation that we find ourselves in, a situation that we have done to ourselves. Let me also mention very quickly that there are natural causes to global warming. It's not all human-made, but those are very small compared to the human activities that have tremendously increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. And if you go to my website again, scifun.org, scifun.org, you'll find an array of information which will help increase your knowledge, not only about fireworks, but also about global warming and ways to mitigate global warming and what is it that makes carbon dioxide a greenhouse gas. And Larry, you know, I ask this question every time I'm on your show. The four biggest gases that are responsible for global warming, carbon dioxide is one, laughing gas is another one, methane is the third one. What's the fourth one? Do you remember what the fourth one is?
No, I don't. Right off the top of my head.
It's water vapor.
Oh, water vapor, right.
Water vapor. We can't do anything about water vapor. That's part of the water cycle. But we can do much about producing carbon dioxide, also laughing gas, nitrous oxide, and the use of methane. Just becoming at least more aware and hopefully taking responsible action about the chemicals that are in the environment is crucial to our well-being.
Peter in Racine has a question. I think that relates to this. Peter, hello.
Hello, Larry, and your guest, Takashiri. When I was a kid in elementary school, I got an old book. Well, maybe it's from the 1950s, and they said atmospheric oxygen is about 28-24%, I forget. And now it's down, last I heard, about 17% to 12%, depending. Had it measured when I was by Lake Michigan, there's more oxygen there. And it was, when it was a warmer season, it was 17%. So when I was in San Diego, 5%, this was 1983, 5%, where there were a few highways, and there weren't even that many turbochargers sucking up atmospheric oxygen. And now it seems like all the auto manufacturers putting out turbochargers, which suck in more atmospheric air with the oxygen. And my God, you know, but this was between two highways by San Diego, 5%. It was in the newspaper, 1983.
Atmospheric oxygen percentages. Back in the 50s, it was like 20%. Now, more recently, 17%. And in some cases, along some highways, 5%.
It's fairly stable, around 20%. It drops a little bit depending on what immediate environment you're in and what else is happening in that environment. So all the data that Peter has shared with us reflect measurements, local measurements, yes. There is no, as far as I know, as far as I can tell, there is no consequence to thinking that the amount of oxygen in the air is going to change.
Okay.
So I hope that's reassuring. But, you know, in science, we do experiments and we learn. And we change the point of view that we develop. So, but yes, oxygen, nitrogen is about 80%, and oxygen is about 20%. And the carbon dioxide is very small. At 420 parts per million is really, really small.
Yeah. Peter,
but
thank you.
Very, very consequential.
Peter, thank you so much. Tom in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I know I'm off topic, Dr. Shakashiri, and when my grandkids visit, we're always going to your website and doing some experiment. But they live 300 miles away, and they want to do more. Are there any books you can recommend besides going to your website where these kids can read about it and do it on their own?
Oh,
yes, yes, yes. I will, in the next couple of days, when I post the summary of this conversation that we're having right now, I will also post a list of books that are suitable for different age groups. Yes, there are many things, but I will post them on my website. That's the only way you can get to what I'm saying, other than what to hear me say now. Yes, it's very important for kids of all ages, not only the youngsters, all kids of all ages, to learn about advances in science and in technology, the benefits of those advances, and the potential hazards. And but the joy of learning is very important, and parental involvement is crucial in the development and the growth of children.
So scifund.org, and you will have that posted in the next few days, couple of days.
Yes.
Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the environmental. I mean, you get a sense, the things you were talking about, do you get a sense that voters care about these topics?
Yes, I get a very good sense that voters care. I would like to get the same good sense that voters are going to vote. This is why I asked at the beginning of our conversation here to and asked everyone to recruit 5 new voters who have not voted before so that we can participate in the democratic society that we all belong to. So, yes, voters, when informed, they make good judgments. So I urge everyone to raise your voice and to vote in every election. And Larry, permit me to once again give this quotation from President Abraham Lincoln. President Lincoln said, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed." That's why it's really crucial to participate in our democratic institutions, and especially as we think about our Independence Day and celebrate our independence and think about ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, and the future of the planet. It is crucial for everyone to participate as a citizen, responsible citizen. And so I'd like to say, do I have a couple of more seconds, Larry?
Yeah, yes, you do. Go ahead.
So, if you remember anything from what I've been sharing with you, I'd like you to remember 4 words. I want you to remember the word freedom, the word liberty, the word responsibility, and the word citizenship. Without freedom, we cannot exist as a nation. Freedom gives us opportunities to learn more, and because we are free, we can help advance liberty in our society. But along with freedom and liberty comes responsibility. And that's why we have to be responsible to ourselves and to each other. And citizenship, I've already mentioned the importance of participating in what our citizenship entitles us to do.
But Sam, on that note, I thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to another visit. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a first holder of the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Great to have him with us. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And all of these shows are all a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And of course, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.